Good evening and welcome to The Final Draft, Books and Writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor.
And I'm Netta Vanavak. And tonight we're going for a stroll down empty suburban streets and across wide open isolated paddocks as we have a look at what constitutes Australian Gothic. It's not always haunted houses, long white dresses and psychological thrills. Or is it?
I spoke to writer Chi Vu, who has transposed a gruesome Buddhist folk tale to the immigrant Vietnamese community of 1980s Footscray. And Chloe Hooper came in to see you, didn't she, Netta, for a chat about her return to fiction with The Engagement, an unsettling exploration of sexual fantasy.
Yes, she did. And then later in the show, we'll have a special take for you on Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, as interpreted by Tim Burton and Vincent Price. All those coming up, so stay with us.
I love learning about animals.
I love smoking pot.
I love sleeping and guitars.
I love nerdy political discussions.
Share the love. Support Real Radio.
You might be more familiar with Chloe Hooper's work in non-fiction and for her highly acclaimed book The Tall Man, which won just about every literary prize under the sun and was adapted into a documentary last year. But before she wrote The Tall Man, she wrote fiction, and it's to fiction that she's returned with her third book, The Engagement. It follows a young English woman who moves to Australia and becomes a real estate agent due to debt and begins a sexual game with one of her customers.
Alexander is a country gentleman who believes that Lise is a prostitute, and when he invites her to his farm for a paid long weekend, he ups the stakes and introduces his own fantasies to the point where Lise doesn't know what game she's playing, or even if it is a game at all.
Chloe popped into the studio while she was visiting Sydney this week to chat to me about classic gothic storylines, the comforts of fiction, and 50 Shades of Grey. I found it really hilarious when you said that you were afraid you'd written a literary 50 Shades of Grey.
That's right. I hadn't read Shades of Grey, and then when my book, The Engagement, went to the publishers, it seemed as though all of the noise about that series just sort of became sort of amplified, and each day I'd open up the paper and there'd be another article about what it meant that women were buying this book in droves, and I knew it was about a man and a woman, and that's what I had written about, and so I did panic.
So you kind of unwittingly tapped in to a trend that you maybe didn't want to be a part of.
Gosh, if you could sort of ride in E.L. James' slipstream, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing. I'm not sure, though, if I've written an erotic novel or actually an anti-erotic novel, so perhaps I've started my own trend.
How would you classify anti-erotic, then?
In this book, it's about a young woman who arrives in Australia. She's English and she's in a lot of debt. Her name's Lise. And she decides that by kind of living out her own version of a Belle de Jour fantasy, that this will be a path to, she sees it as a kind of erotic game which could bring in easy money, and it starts to go wrong when she finds she's trapped in someone else's fantasy. So in a way, it's a book about desire and fantasy going wrong.
It's interesting too, because I think one of the scariest parts of it to me was this notion that this fantasy that she has conjured is being completely subsumed by somebody else's, and this idea of can women have their own fantasies that are never going to be part of some larger male fantasy? Is that even a question, really?
Well, I mean, I do see the book as being about two common fantasies in a way colliding, and that is this idea of prostitution as an erotic game. And she has this fantasy, but it sort of butts up against, she meets this lonely farmer who thinks that by proposing marriage, he'll save a fallen woman, which is obviously another archetypal fantasy. Although I hope that in the book, it's actually never quite clear who's in control. So who's, in the end, whose fantasy it really was, is up for grabs.
Well, it's a fantasy within a fantasy, almost.
That's right.
This idea of prostituting yourself in the fantasy is really interesting. This notion of, you know, commodification, and do we have a price? And if we do have a price, what is it? And what does that even buy? And how Lise explores that. I mean, she gets in over her head pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess I love gothic fiction, and it's a kind of, I guess it's a classic storyline, being trapped in a house as she becomes. Also, the forced betrothal narrative is another classic gothic plot, and historically that's been a way that women have played out their own desire for and anxiety around marriage, or, which obviously in the years past, as the stakes have been much higher in terms of who you married and what effect that would have on your life. I mean, of course, it still does today, but for women, you know, you really had to marry. And I think though that I was wanting to explore those questions of what it means to be owned by somebody, and the part that money plays, you know, can everyone be bought? And what does it mean to sort of be a participant in this sort of modern economy where, as you say, everything has a price, and in a way she's in debt. What is debt but actually living a pretend life, a kind of fantasy life of I can buy, you know, I should have these things, this car, this house, these clothes, because that's, you know, then I'll be the real me.
It's interesting that you say that as well, that you're playing with these kind of traditional storylines, because it is inverted. As much as we're looking at the storyline of, you know, having this Austen-style happily ever after marriage, there's also this sexual fantasy of prostitution. And for Lise, it seems like it's the emotional entanglement that's much more terrifying to her than anything physical that could have arisen from her own fantasy.
Yes, she's full of ambivalence about making a commitment, and in a way it's her worst nightmare is to be trapped in a house with somebody who's about to call in the vicar and find his mother's wedding dress in the trunk in the attic.
And impregnate her and hold her hostage on this property forever.
That's right. Yes. But, you know, and then there's another point where she half thinks to herself, maybe I would never do this any other way, and this is what it would take to get me to walk down the aisle. So I had some fun, as you say, sort of inverting the genre, playing with those kind of gothic tropes.
Towing the line of melodrama.
Yeah. And I'm very interested in genre fiction, but then actually how you can unpick it and stretch it and bend it and bring it into the modern world.
So does there always have to be a house? You know, does it have to be this house in which they're imprisoned? Does it have to be this kind of isolation? Is that part of Australian Gothic as well, or is that something we've inherited?
I think it's definitely something we've inherited. I think you've, you know, thrown out the challenge there to Australian Gothic writers that, you know, if there has to be other ways. I mean, I suppose there are. The isolation is always, I guess, a kind of
necessity.
A necessity, you know. So I did actually. I was looking for a house outside the city, because if we were trapped in this radio station, you could just kind of open the window and wave at someone, and hopefully they'd
by one of the three exits.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
The landscape as well is almost as much of a character as the two people moving within it. And that's something that I felt with the Child's Book of True Crime too. You've got two really similar protagonists in a way. They're both quite unreliable. There is this gothic undertone. Is that something that you consciously return to?
There are kinds of stories that I really enjoy reading, so maybe this is my kind of, you know, fan fiction, just to bring E.L. James back into the conversation.
The two of them, they are quite similar in a lot of ways, but you'd separated them with A Tall Man. Was it difficult coming back to fiction, or was it kind of like putting on a comfy dressing gown and going for it?
Well, yeah, there's lots of sort of comfort in fiction, in that I could close the door of my study and know that none of the characters were going to leap off the page and threaten me with legal action. And there is a kind of, you know, your imagination can be a kind of balm, especially after some of the horrors that I feel I was writing about in Tall Man.
So there was never a fear. I mean, I find working in nonfiction that there's sometimes this fear of getting a little too imaginative, because you have it drilled into you that these are real people's
absolutely.
Lives and can't take any liberties.
And yes.
To then be able to imagine things, it almost seems like the scope is so great that it can be a bit crippling.
It's a sort of liberation. But, it, you know, I guess that one of the hard things about nonfiction is that you can't change the ending, and yet, you know, the story makes its own tracks, which you just have to follow. And obviously with fiction, you know, you've got to kind of get out your sleepers and your, you know, and lay the tracks yourself. So there is that difference.
That was Chloe Hooper there speaking about her new book, The Engagement.
If you subscribe to 2SER before November 15, as well as supporting your favourite community radio station, you'll go in the draw for some amazing prizes. Follow the links at 2SER.com and you could win return flights to Malaysia, a $1,000 bike package, 12-month gym memberships, or CDs for a whole year. There are also DJing and music production packages, courses at the 2SER School of Radio, and tickets to Playground Weekender and Pete's Reach Festival up for grabs. So head to 2SER.com before 12 noon on November 15 and say hello, radio, my old friend.
Angulima is a central figure in a traditional Buddhist folktale, a deranged killer who wears his victims' fingers in a garland around his neck. In her reworking of the tale, published as part of Girimondo Books' short series, Melbourne-based author and playwright Chi Vu presents him as a menacing abattoir worker with bags of stinking meat, who moves into the Vietnamese community of Footscray in early 80s Melbourne, interrupting the carefully maintained world of Dao and her all-female boarding house.
Chi's adaptation draws on the haunting memories of refugee communities to create a truly terrifying gothic tale. This is Chi Vu reading from Angulima.
Dao reached between the collected jars and bottles filled with bulbous pickled vegetables, vinegars, chili paste, fermented prawn paste, fish and oyster sauces. The paper labels on the damp, backlit bottles and jars were wrinkled. Her fridge was so crammed she often couldn't see what she'd bought only last week from Dim Bazaar. Dao's plump right hand had squeezed between the plastic takeaway containers to the very back corner of her old fridge. Then she felt it, a small cellophane bag of bird's eye chilies. Dao lunged at the bottles and jars, which made a glass squeaking sound, before she was able to reach the bag with the tips of her fingers. She gave a hard pull to retrieve her arm from the fridge. Dao trimmed the fresh chili with a pair of scissors and crushed the fleshy slivers into some table salt, staining it with the chili's thin red juice. What a trio they made, Dao thought. Three women in a drafty old house without their husbands, children, siblings, fathers or mothers, without any men folk. And now this was about to change somewhat. Her tenants waited as she returned to the table with a plate of sliced green apples and the chili dipping salt. Dao placed the cut apples in front of them and told them about Angulima. The young woman Sin sat forward on her seat. Her slender arms rested awkwardly on the table, and her bright, dark eyes seemed to look up at something high on the wall that Dao couldn't see. Sin was 19, 20 in Vietnamese years because the period of gestation is counted, and had escaped by herself as a 16-year-old. Like Dao, she had a talent for finding things and came across many useful items that people had discarded or simply forgot and never looked for. Her dry, rough hands betrayed her occupation cleaning houses and motel rooms. The other tenant was an old woman who shared the studio room in the backyard with Sin. Bach was seated partially in the light. Strands of her grey hair were combed loosely along her shiny scalp, while everywhere else, skin had the texture of a soft, dry paper bag. Buck's face remained impassive when Dao told them about the new tenant who was going to stay in the garage. Dao decided to lighten things up, seeing that had now given them news that would surely affect their daily routine. She stared at Sin's shiny black hair, which fell down to the middle of her back. "You're very skinny. You've got to eat more," Dao teased playfully. Sin's slender fingers picked up a slice of apple and dipped into the chili salt. "Your hair is very dark and very strong. Maybe it eats all the food that goes into your stomach." Bach's thin shoulders shook as she laughed at the idea of apple turning into long black hair. "But I eat everything I can," Sin replied. And it was the truth, too. Dao had seen her empty a large bowl of rice, sometimes as many as three in one sitting. But the girl could work hard as well, and it was this vigour that would ensure her survival beyond these threadbare years. The three women heard the sound of keys jangling outside the house, accompanied by muscular footsteps. "It must be the new stranger," the old woman whispered. stranger now, but acquaintance later, Dow reassured her tenants. I had a long talk with him yesterday. Having him around the house could be useful. She noticed that Bach didn't respond again, but continued looking at the plates of apples. Don't worry, he's only staying for a month or two. If he's no good, he'll be gone soon, Dow reassured them. The side gates clicked. Finn's face was as fresh as an apple as she listened to the oncoming steps. Dow noticed the reflected white light on the girl's shiny hair as one strand seemed to defy gravity and stand up slightly. The women sat at the table in silence. Their ears followed the heavy, irregular steps as they walked down the side of the house. Outside, the wind picked up and blew against all the external surfaces and gaps between them. The house itself seemed to whisper and gasp with his approach, for the women could hear every creak and reverberation from its old frame. The door opened, and the new tenant came in. He had a large bag over one of his shoulders. He was a tall and rather thin man. He seemed to bear the weight of the heavy bag quite easily. He was no longer a youth, and yet certainly not old. Welcome, come in, Dow said. Why didn't you come through the front? Hello, all, he said, after taking in the room and its occupants. I like feeling at home. He lowered the plastic bag onto the laminate table, rather than feeling like a guest. His voice had the warmth of a guitar on a still, idle night. Through the clear plastic, the women could see the meat and bones tightly pressed against the bag. The marrow in the sawn bones was still rich and wet. The landlady estimated he had brought 25 kilograms home. Oh, so much meat, Sin said, holding a polite smile on her lips. Work. They gave it to me. I'm at the place along the river. The fridge turned itself on, and a corner of the plastic bag leaked droplets of blood onto Dow's kitchen floor. He was said to have lived in the time of the Buddha, Siddhartha, so ancient India. He was led astray by a false teacher who told him that to attain enlightenment he'd have to kill 1,000 people. And as a way of keeping count, he started chopping off one of their fingers, each of his victims' fingers, and wearing it as a necklace, a garland of fingers. And that's what Angulimala actually means, garland of fingers. So the story goes, he'd killed 999 people when he came across the Buddha and suddenly came to his senses and then became the Buddha's disciple and began his own path to enlightenment. I was just really struck by the character and also by how he started out as this terrible, terrible man who would kill people. And then by the end, he had become enlightened. And you know, when he was himself attacked, you know, physically attacked, his response was a little bit like Jesus Christ's, you know, turn the other cheek. So I thought that was a really nice way of thinking about redemption.
And why did you choose to translate the tale to the suburban Melbourne setting?
That was more to do with my sense that there weren't enough stories that looked at the migrant condition, the refugee experience, especially the Vietnamese Australian refugee story. I didn't set out to say, all right, the traditional tale is obviously resonating with the Vietnamese community. But as I wrote it, I started finding intersections between the traditional tale and the experience of the migrant condition. I was more interested in the Gothic genre because it was a way for me to have the creative freedom, really load the story up with a sense of menace, you know, to bring out the goriness of the traditional Buddhist tale. Then I was exploring doubles, twins, the house sinking, madness, dreams, the sense of the uncanny, also exploring our fear of the land and our sense of trespassing.
2SER. 107.3 FM.
In 1988, film director Tim Burton managed to find a way to combine a stop-motion animation with his great hero, the actor Vincent Price, and the rhymes of Dr. Seuss. Vincent Molloy, a young boy, idolises the actor Vincent Price, who narrates this story. He's fascinated by the gothic horror tales of Edgar Allan Poe, and the more he reads them, the more detached he becomes from reality, becoming convinced that he's a tormented artist and beginning to quote parts of Poe's poem, The Raven, as he goes slowly insane. What does something like that even sound like? Here we have it for you, Tim Burton's Vincent.
Vincent Molloy is 7 years old. He's always polite and does what he's told. For a boy his age, he's considerate and nice. But he wants to be just like Vincent Price. He doesn't mind living with his sister, dog, and cats, though he'd rather share a home with spiders and bats. There he could reflect on the horrors he's invented. And wander dark hallways alone and tormented. Vincent is nice when his aunt comes to see him, but imagines dipping her in wax for his wax museum. He likes to experiment on his dog, Abercrombie, in the hopes of creating a horrible zombie. So he and his horrible zombie dog could go searching for victims in the London fog. His thoughts, though, aren't only of ghoulish crime. He likes to paint and read to pass some of the time. While other kids read books like Go, Jane, Go, Vincent's favorite author is Edgar Allan Poe. One night, while reading a gruesome tale, he read a passage that made him turn pale. Such horrible news he could not survive, for his beautiful wife had been buried alive. He dug out her grave to make sure she was dead, unaware that her grave was his mother's flower bed. His mother sent Vincent off to his room. He knew he'd been banished to the Tower of Doom, where he was sentenced to spend the rest of his life alone with the portrait of his beautiful wife. While alone and insane, encased in his doom, Vincent's mother burst suddenly into the room. She said, "If you want to, you can go out and play. It's sunny outside and a beautiful day." Vincent tried to talk, but he just couldn't speak. The years of isolation had made him quite weak. So he took out some paper and scrawled with a pen, "I am possessed by this house and can never leave it again." His mother said, "You're not possessed and you're not almost dead. These games that you play are all in your head. You're not Vincent Price, you're Vincent Molloy. You're not tormented or insane, you're just a young boy. You're 7 years old and you are my son. I want you to get outside and have some real fun." Her anger now spent, she walked out through the hall. And while Vincent backed slowly against the wall, the room started to sway, to shiver and creak. His horrid insanity had reached its peak. He saw Abercrombie, his zombie slave, and heard his wife call from beyond the grave. She spoke from her coffin and made ghoulish demands, while through cracking walls reached skeleton hands. Every horror in his life that had crept through his dreams swept his mad laughter to terrified screams. To escape the madness, he reached for the door, but fell limp and lifeless down on the floor. His voice was soft and very slow as he quoted the Raven from Edgar Allan Poe. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
And that's all we have time for this week. The show can be podcast from our website at www.2ser.com and follow the links to Final Draft.
Next week, we're going on a little jaunt to the Middle East, so please join us on Monday from 7. Until then.